Chili Dilly, the personality pickle.
Hi, I'm Greg, and I'm a nerd.
You must be kidding, aren't you?
I have never seen anything like this.
The worst part has been watching of the movie. Some of these were pretty terrible. Good evening and welcome back to Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. We are here, season two, and we are in our first category, which is Guilty Pleasures. And we are in battle number three of Guilty Pleasures. Welcome to my co-host, Eric. How you doing, buddy?
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Now, we had technical difficulties yesterday. We could not go live. What happened? I'm going to put you on the spot.
I had a mental breakdown in a variety of ways, including not preparing all the things for the show that I was supposed to.
It was kind of funny because I was sitting down here getting everything ready. And I had the countdown up and everything like that. And I sent you a text. I'm like, hey, buddy, you got those images from the... And when you replied, just simply, fuck. I went, he's got to be joking. So I sent you a little laugh. Yeah, right. It was very funny. Very funny. Now, where are those images for the movies?
Yeah. Well, probably, for the best.
It's okay.
We're here.
Yes.
We're queer.
Get used to it. I've been getting used to it for a long time. It's time the rest of the world got used to it. But anyway, the thing is that we are back for another night. It's just one night. We are going to have a good show tonight. We're still in Guilty Pleasures. We're back on your side of the bracket, which should be a lot of fun. Let's take a look at the bracket real quick. Here's what we've done so far. We've had two battles. We had Legally Blonde, which in a shocker upset The Devil Wears Prada. Well, that was on audience vote, actually. And then we had on the other side, actually, I think we both chose Legally Blonde, to be honest with you, and the audience voted for Legally Blonde, too. So not as much of an upset as you would think. And then last week, Roller Boogie, which is a personal favorite of mine, did not expect it to win, was beat by pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping, and rewatching it again, clearly deserved to win. It's an amazing comedy. If you haven't seen it, it's underrated in my opinion.
It's the funniest thing I've seen all year.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You had not seen it.
No. And I may watch it again really soon. It's so fucking funny.
It is worth a rewatch. I've watched it multiple times because it's one of those things like a good sitcom. Like if you watch The Office over and over again, the one-liners don't get old. There's so many of them, they're easy to forget. And so yeah, they have some really good jokes in it. And now what we've got is the next battle is up there in the top left, and that is Dude, Where's My Car versus the number one seed. Now Dude is the eighth seed, but only because he was on your side of the bracket. It's a lot of technical things, we're not going to get into it, but it's the eighth seed. It's going up against the one seed in Moulin Rouge tonight. Both of these are your picks.
Is there a movie that's rated less than 5.5 on IMDb? Was it your Roller Boogie?
I think Roller Boogie was 4.7, I think we said. So, yeah. So,
yeah.
But like, Rotten Tomatoes rating of Dude, Where's My Car is like 16%. I looked that up.
It's fucking crazy. Like, all right. Well, listen. Sometimes, and as we know, like, I want you to think about this. We can just jump right into Dude, Where's My Car?
Go for it. Well, before we do, there's something I do want to say, but go ahead and do that, and then we'll jump into
it. When Jesus...
Uh-oh.
Well, why don't you go ahead, and then I'll get into Dude, Where's My Car?
Before we get into sacrilege here, let me do one thing real quick. I think the whole world is doing this. And just want to bring up the fact that yesterday, the world... If you're a music fan, or even if not, just a cultural icon, we lost in the saddest of sense, and that was Ozzy Osbourne passing away. He did the concert in Birmingham, England a couple of weeks ago, and I was on the fence to whether to pay $30 for the pay-per-view, And I looked at the lineup, and it, it, you know, it had some bands I really liked, like Mastodon and Slayer and
Brontosaurus, Stegosaurus.
You know, it had the kind of revamped Alice in Chains. And then it turned out that they had all of these guest appearances. Pantera was in there, and it was just a really good lineup. So it was an all day thing. It started at like 10 o'clock and went, I you know, just kept waiting for Ozzy, waiting for Black Sabbath to finish the thing out. And I'm so glad I got this. And this was a clip from when Ozzy finally came out. Couldn't stand, of course, because of the Parkinson's and the nerve damage that he has in his spine. But man, singing Mama, I'm Coming Home to a crowd just as they're crying. They make him cry. And it was just this big emotional moment. I mean, you could see that on the screen here. People just kind of losing it. And it's so crazy to think that this was just a couple weeks ago. And then he's gone. But I tell you what, man, if you're going to go out... good night. That's one way to go out, is just with a bang.
Did you cry?
What, during this?
Mm-hmm.
During Mama, I'm Coming Home?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I didn't like, I was more like the girl on the right there, just a little pouty lip out, not full on weeping. I wasn't sobbing into a tissue.
Yeah, you're known for that, though, the pouty lip thing.
I am.
The pouty yeah. lip. I'm Greg and I'm Sid.
But it was
where that came from.
But I tell you what, man, I mean, anybody that's a fan of metal, a fan of just good rock and roll, I mean, you had to love Ozzy down the road. One way or another, he's touched everybody who's a rock fan. So I was, you know, saddened to hear about his passing. I think everybody's done their tributes, and I think we would have been remiss if we didn't mention the godfather of metal, dead at 76 yesterday. So
this just in, if you're tuning in for the first time and hearing this, folks, breaking news from Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric.
Breaking so. News. We're a little late. If we would have done it yesterday when we were supposed to do this show.
Yeah, but it's an audio medium, this podcast. You know, we stream it so people can watch it. But in theory,
yes,
it's consumed via
it audio. Is. It is. We just crossed the 500 listener mark this week.
Holy hell.
So, not too bad.
People.
Yeah, just... I'll have to show you the geographic breakdown. We have about 83 listeners in Toronto. Don't ask me. Don't ask me. They must be starving for entertainment in Canada right now. So, to all of our Canadian listeners that stream our podcast, tell me what it's all about, and good day.
That's a statistical anomaly. Mm-hmm. You're kind of up there, right? In that general area. You know, you're only about 12 hours from Toronto.
Yeah, they might be able to smell me. That I grew up just over the... I grew up in Detroit, right near Windsor. Yeah, I grew up in Detroit, right across the river from Windsor.
It's one of the only places where you travel south to get into Canada.
Pretty
from
much.
The United States. Mm-hmm. I learned that hosting trivia, Greg.
Very nice.
Which I used to do.
Well, we do trivia on this show when it has to do with the movies. So,
you know what? Yeah. Okay, here's the trivia question. You know who fucking hated Ozzy Osbourne?
Who?
My parents.
Oh, I can imagine.
Were convinced that he was actually the devil. And for those of you who don't know, I was raised in a very conservative, very conservative Christian household. And so, this was during the early 80s, right? So the Dungeons and Dragons, hysteria. My parents weren't about to let me go over to my friend Tony's house and play Dungeons and Dragons, lest I fall into the occult.
It could have happened.
Ozzy Osbourne. I mean, so we listened strictly to Christian music at home, and maybe sometimes my parents might listen to Kenny Rogers or Ronnie Millsap, some older country.
Right.
Or 80s country. So I heard rock and roll music at friends' houses. And I remember hearing Def Leppard for the first time. I remember hearing Guns N' Roses for the first time and thinking this is badass. But I also heard it at the roller skating rink, you know,
we talked about that. Darren Roller Boogie.
And I mean, wonder why me and my brother loved going up there. But yes, my parents were not a fan of Ozzy Osbourne.
The Satanic Panic was what it was known as. It was a crazy time because rock and roll had changed. And what was so interesting about it was in the 80s, they were all wearing makeup and spandex. I mean, you had the hard heavy metal, but Ozzy was wearing makeup and had his hair teased, doing the Ultimate Sin and Shot in the Dark. And it was the song, I think it was Suicide Solution, that started where the kid killed himself and they sued Ozzy, and then every parent in America would forbid, and then the biting off of the heads of bats and stuff, which was the urban legend. And
here in Texas, he peed on the Alamo, which is a big no-no. You're only supposed to poop on it.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I'll make sure. Was the big deal. They don't always go into great detail about it. But
I will make sure that I poop on the Alamo next time I'm there.
You're allowed to poop on it. just not pee. You know, they just bought Pee Wee Herman's bike.
I heard it. I was just going to say the same thing. That to me is one of the coolest things ever for any entity, you know, that a landmark of some sign, because everybody knows that Pee Wee Herman's bike is in the basement of the Alamo, and to have them put it on display, I think that's incredible. And now I want to go to the Alamo. You think there's going to be a lot of people now.
You've never been to the Alamo?
No, I want to go to the Alamo again. I've been to the Alamo. But I want to go again now to see Pee Wee Herman's bike.
Okay, another trivia question for you. Then I swear to God we'll get into this show. But which rock and roll drummer is like the world's foremost, maybe not expert on the Alamo, but has purchased and has the largest private collection of Alamo memorabilia?
Oh, wow. The only one that comes to mind is Lars.
It's not Lars. It's Phil Collins.
Oh, wow.
Phil Collins loves him some the That's Alamo. Crazy.
He loves
him. I think you're not allowed to say the Alamo. Alamo. It's the Alamo.
Yeah, it's the Alamo. I think you're not supposed to say Alamo.
So he loves Alamo.
He loves Always a rebel, our Eric. Always.
I'm from here, and I can call it whatever.
Challenging the status quo. But yeah, no, I think that's really cool. I mean, he loves him some Texas independence, that's for sure. But yeah, so let's get into these movies.
Okay, so in Jesus.
Oh my goodness, here we go. He's going back to the sacrilege. All right, go for it. I'm not going to interrupt.
I'm just talking about things that in their time are not appreciated, Greg.
Oh, okay. That's true.
I mean, a week before Jesus is hanging on a cross, it's fucking Palm Sunday, dude, and they are welcoming him into the city, laying palm leaves at the foot of his donkey.
Similar to Nickelback, very, you know, celebrated at one time and then considered, you know, just uncool. Just not any, and so are you tying that to Dude, Where's My Car? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, because the criminally underrated movie, Dude, Where's My Car? If what you say is true, that it has a 16% on Rotten Tomatoes.
It does, yes.
It is simply because people don't see it for what it is. And what it is a shitty movie.
It is that.
That is fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
And isn't trying to be fucking Citizen Kane, which also is a shitty movie. It's trying to be a funny, stupid stoner comedy. It pulls it off perfectly. It's just as funny as any of the stoner comedies that we think are the good ones, like that had
Dazed and Confused.
No, not that. It had Chappelle and what's the name of that fucking movie? Okay. Movie I'm thinking of is Half-Baked, by the way.
Oh, I was thinking like Dazed and Confused, but yeah, Half-Baked was another one.
Right, and so we consider these, the Harold and Kumar and whatever. Why we consider those to be the good ones and Dude, Where's My Car to be the shitty one is fucking beyond me. This thing starts out funny, and it is funny really the entire way through, as long as they're not trying at all to be serious. And they only try it like a couple of times.
Right.
Those scenes suck. Take away from everything else about the movie. I'm sorry. If you walk up to any person on the street and go, and then?
Oh, yeah.
You know what they're going to do? Yeah. I refuse to play your Chinese food mind games. It's... it's rewatchable because, and it's what makes it a guilty pleasure. It's rewatchable because it requires no effort on your part participate in it or find it funny. It requires no effort for you to have kept up with any of the story up to whatever point you start watching it, or from that point to the end. It's just a series of vignettes, and it's one of those, the people you meet along the way, and the story gets more and more kind of outrageous the more you stick with it. And it feels to me like people expected it or expect it to be something it's not. And I don't think it's fair to give it 16% when it's trying to be a 16% movie. So 16 out of 16 is what? 100%. This movie's 100%. I rest my case. That's math. Simple math.
Well, so I think, critics, I mean, any comedy that isn't Woody Allen or Cerebral at that time in the 90s, they considered to be complete and utter trash. If it wasn't John Hughes or something, that it was a thinking man's comedy, then it wasn't considered good. So you had a lot of movies like that. They didn't like American Pie when it came out. And, you know, for what American Pie was then, was an iconic series of movies about the coming of age type story. Granted, it had been copied from previous iterations. But I think with Dude, Where's My Car? I think you're underselling it a little bit. Now, I will say this. Initially, rewatching it again, some of the banter, because it's so ridiculous, the shibby and all that, it can get a little grating. I'm not going to lie that I was, but that's a very minor. Like, it's like if there's something that just is, it's a very minor thing for me.
Like sand in your ass when you go to the beach. Exactly. The whole beach was fun.
Yes.
But my butthole hurts. Now.
There's a lot of things you can say for that.
Yes.
But.
Family trips.
With Uncle Lonnie. But anyway, so the thing is with Dude, Where's My Car? Is that once you get into it and the plot starts to unfold and it's got this mystery of where's the pudding come from, you know, before they even get to the car, there's all these weird things that are happening that don't quite make sense. And as I was watching it and they built this set of mystery, there was one thing that came to mind that I think copied this idea. And there's actually a few films that came out after this that copied it. And
Memento?
Memento is one.
Are you serious?
Yes. Memento is one that came to mind. I'm like, this is Memento, but with stoners. And The Hangover.
Yeah.
The Hangover takes place after everything has happened and they've lost the groom and they have to retrace their steps. There's all these madcap characters. I think somebody saw Dude, Where's My Car? And started to sit down, I'm going to write a bro version.
A little more sophisticated.
Yeah, but still zany, madcap, crazy night. And that's basically what Dude, Where's My Car is. It's them trying to retrace their steps to figure out where the car is, but also solve the mystery. And that's where the kind of the genius in the film is, as far as where the humor comes from. Because that plot keeps you engaged. And drags you along through them just acting like imbeciles.
I wonder, because now that you mention The Hangover, it makes me wonder if there's some sort of, and today I don't think there would be, but this movie came out in 2000. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously stoner culture has been a thing for a while. But I wondered if you called this movie How Drunk Was I Last Night? And you cast Danny McBride and, you know,
Zach Galifianakis again.
Yeah, somebody like that. Like that. And it was basically the same plot, but like you said, or, you know, instead of pot, it's, you know,
alcohol.
How much did we drink last night? It's kind of The Hangover. And you can pull off 70% of these jokes by replacing, you know, how high were we with how drunk were we? And I bet you it's better received than this one is. I mean, I don't know anybody that doesn't like Dude, Where's My Car? So apparently I'm in the 84% of people.
That's the thing is that, it, you know, we know critic and audience. I think the audience rating might have been around 56%. Because there are people that of different generations. I remember when this came out, and I was in my late 20s, and my nephew was going to see it at the movie theater with a friend, and my brother looked at the poster and automatically, and people still do this today, automatically judge the film.
Yes.
What kind of title is Dude, Where's My Car? This looks stupid. These two idiots are stupid. But here's the funny thing about that. Because I'm looking at him and I'm like, dude, you love Cheech and Chong.
Right.
He was a huge Cheech and Chong fan, but this is too lowbrow for him.
This is a bridge too far.
A bridge too far.
Yeah, the name isn't helping. Dude, Where's My Car? You know, Ashton Kutcher at the time is just simply the kid from That 70s Show. Mm-hmm. And then this. Sean William Scott is just Stifler.
Yeah.
Kind of
just getting
rehashed
started.
As a stoner. Yeah. And by the way, so Sean William Scott was in a bunch of stuff like this early on. And then I don't feel like I hear from him at all.
I know.
Anymore.
Yeah.
And I wonder he either, and I'm not going to look it up. Someone else can do that. Our producer can look it up. He either got really religious, I bet, or fingered somebody.
It depends on who.
That he shouldn't have.
I think he aged. Some of these actors who aren't, you know, they aren't thespians, you know, that can.
He went to like Juilliard.
I mean.
I'm kidding.
If he did, it doesn't show. But you had me for a second there because I was like, you must know. But like your Jake Gyllenhaal's of the world that can stick around. Brad Pitt's who he used to do, you know, romantic. Matthew McConaughey sticks around. I think Sean William Scott's kind of aged out of Stifler. And he's just not. That was the part he got typecast in everything. He was always that guy that would pop in and even doing cameos. Because I love him in Old School with the dart gun at the petting zoo. And yeah. I think one of my favorite all-time Sean William Scott cameos is in a movie that most people hate, and that's Cop Out with Bruce Willis. That was a Kevin Smith movie. It was like really, it's considered a really, really, really bad movie. But he plays a burglar. Bruce Willis is a cop. He plays a burglar that breaks into people's houses and takes a dump, and he's called the Turd Burglar. And it cracks me up. And he's the bright spot in that movie. He's only in it for maybe 15, 20 minutes, but it's great. But I think that when you're doing these roles like Stifler and Jesse, he's Jesse, right? I can't remember which is which.
Yeah, Ashton Kutcher's Jesse.
Oh, okay.
Sean is called Chester.
Chester, okay. So you're doing these roles. You're just going to get typecast, and then there's nothing more for you to do when you hit 35. You can just always play that frat boy, but there's no room for frat boys in Hollywood these days.
We're not making these movies.
No, we're not.
This is so of its time.
Yeah.
And as were the Old Schools and the American Pies and kind of those zany comedies. We're not making zany anymore. We're not making anything zany.
The new Naked Gun is coming out.
Okay. So that, and I've seen, okay, there was a Ricky Gervais show. I think it's called
Extras.
I'm not sure if it was that. I don't know. Liam Neeson comes in and wants to do comedy, and it's a sketch, you know, that they set up, and it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. He wants to break into comedy roles, but he can't help but be Liam Neeson, and so it's Ricky Gervais and Stephen Marchand trying to be funny, and so I mean, what do you think? What do you foresee for Naked Gun?
You know,
we've all been waiting for.
I think I'm going to say this is as silly as it looks and as stupid as the Naked Gun looks. I think my personal heart of hearts, I think people are starved for comedy, especially right now in these days. People need something stupid to laugh at. Yeah. And you look at the trailer for the Naked Gun and it's stupid. It's beyond stupid. But the thing is it's stupid that makes you chuckle a little bit when I've seen the trailer. It does win me over. There's a scene that I saw where, you know, he's playing the son of Frank Drebin. Liam Neeson is playing Leslie Nielsen's son. And then the other guy is playing, you know, his partner's son. And there's a scene where they're looking up at the photos of their dad and kind of talking to their dads who have been deceased. And then they go down the line. And then there's Nordberg's son, which was O.J. Simpson. And he looks up at the photo and he looks at the camera and goes, nah, nah, I don't think so. And that alone right there, that one gag, I think sold a lot of people on the movie. I don't think it'll be, you know, 400 million, but I think it could easily domestically in the U.S., I think it could clear 100. I think there are people, enough people that will want to go see this to make it its money back. And I think we might see another one. I think what's good is Liam Neeson. They chose Liam Neeson of everybody to be Frank Drebin Jr. because he does do that deadpan humor like Leslie Nielsen does. You remember Ted 2?
Yeah.
When he did the Taken monologue in the supermarket that Ted worked at.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great. So yeah, he's just funny in what he does when he tries to do comedy. So I think I'm hopeful for it. I'm hopeful. I don't know if I'll go see it.
It's been a while since we had these. We had them.
Yeah.
The Hot Shots movies and like Top Secret.
Yep.
And I guess later we had like Scary Movie and things like that.
There's another one coming out on Friday, but it's only on Netflix.
The Scary Movie?
Nope. Happy Gilmore 2 comes out on Friday on Netflix.
Yeah, man, I don't know.
You really, when we covered Happy Gilmore on the show, you really liked it. You love Happy Gilmore. But
I don't know about 20 years, 25, 30 years later.
Yeah.
Revisiting the subject matter. Like you either, I mean, I don't know. I guess I can't say. But.
Well, it's a good thing. It's on Netflix. It's out on Friday. You can watch a little bit of it. You don't have to worry about leaving the theater if it sucks. Yeah, I'm hopeful for the fact that golf is one of those sports that you can play. You know, till they have the senior tour, you can play 30 years down the road. So I think for the character, it's going to be an interesting, you know, he's been retired from golf, coming back into it, the cameos and everything. Trailer looks interesting. I'm hopeful for it as well.
He's got to save his grandma's house again.
I think his grandma is gone in this one.
Okay, speaking of cameos, though, in Dude, Where's My Car?
Yes.
We get a young Jennifer Garner.
Mm-hmm.
We get Christy Swanson playing Christy Boner.
Oh, yes.
Comedian David Herman. Comedian Hal Sparks, who plays Zoltan.
Oh, yes.
And then the lesser famous O'Connell brother is also in this. Not Jerry.
Yeah.
The other one.
Dave.
Charlie. Charlie.
Okay, Charlie O'Connell. Yes. The other Dave was not in this one.
And I don't even know if he's credited in this, but there's an Andy Dick.
Oh yes.
Performance.
There's a Dick sighting. There's a Dick sighting. Yes.
Freak in a Cage, which yes. The stories about that guy.
Oh yeah.
Are really problematic. Yeah. Like anybody who's been in LA for more than 1 year has had some sort of traumatic experience.
Yeah. There's a lot of Dick stories regarding that. There are. What? I'm just saying there are. You can look them up. I would say Google Dick Stories. Hollywood. Google Hollywood.
Dick Stories 2. Harry.
Google Dick.
Big Daddy's. Dick Stories.
Freak in a Cage. Throw that in there. You'll get all kinds of results. So.
Probably not the results I want. But it's just one of those, like you said, The Hangover.
Yeah.
It's like a road trip movie. It's like,
it is.
Again, it's the people you meet along the way. You know, you loved that fucking stupid David Lynch, The Straight Story or whatever.
I do, yeah. It's a road movie.
And that was the people you meet along the way. Yep. And
yeah, road movie. Love it.
And this is way better than that movie was. But, I mean, David Lynch directed this one, you know, maybe. It's a masterpiece.
Probably.
But it's although, a guilty pleasure.
It would be incoherent.
Because it fits with, and I want to redefine this, because when we get to Moulin Rouge,
yes,
there's always going to be the exception that proves the rule.
Okay.
But I have defined these guilty pleasures thus far with Devil Wears Prada, with Legally Blonde, and with Dude, Where's My Car? As kind of like, if I'm folding laundry and I see that it's on TV, I'll stop down and watch the movie from wherever it is to the end. I don't need to make an event of it. I don't need to see the beginning of it. And Dude, Where's My Car is easily one of those. If it's on, if I hit play and they're comparing back tattoos and going, what does mine say? I mean, I'm going to laugh at that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and the Korean, you know, owner coming out and getting so fed up with them. And it's like, yours says sweet. Yours says dude. It's just.
Well, let's take a look.
Oh, okay.
I've got it right here.
Nice.
Sweet.
Dude.
It's right here. That's great.
Dude, you got a tattoo. So did you, dude.
No.
Oh, like I'm trying to see it spinning around.
What about mine?
Dude, what does mine say?
Sweet.
What about mine?
Dude, what does mine say?
Sweet.
What about mine?
Dude, what does mine say?
Sweet.
What about mine?
Dude, what does mine say?
Sweet.
What about mine?
Dude, what does mine say?
Sweet. What about mine?
Dude,
what does mine say?
Sweet!
Idiot! Your tattoo says dude. Your tattoo says sweet. Got it?
I do like this where they try to make up. They're going to try to hug it out. Oh, no. Never mind. It's great stuff. Yeah.
So. But he's spinning in circles trying to see his.
I do love that.
Okay, the other underrated like little vignette, and I put a slide on here, is this getting taken to the police station for questioning, then realizing it's not them. So then they meet bumbling cop who impounds their car, then they've got to go get their car. And that little like 10-15 minutes of the movie is such underrated comedy. And they bring the dummy in to play good cop, bad cop, because you're not allowed to, you know, hit people that are in custody.
Yeah,
and so fantastic. Instead they have this dummy, and Chester looking over there as he punches this dummy and throws coffee in his face, and you just see him, you know, like really getting upset that they're treating this plastic dummy this way. And on their way out, he's like, you hang in there, buddy.
You know, I do like how he is so invested in how the dummy is being treated, and he's so upset. It is it is a great moment.
And then the lady who refuses to give them the information at the DMV, and they're trying to reach in there and get it, and she I could give you the information, but it would be against rule 654-32G to give it to you. And man, there's literally nothing wrong with this movie. It's perfect in every way. And I mean, I'm surprised, Greg, to hear that you, with all of your attitude and
my attitude,
have anything nice to say about this. So, I mean, obviously I'm going to gush over it because they were my choice. I want to hear from you where this fits. I mean, we know that it fits in the stoner genre. We know it fits in the zany early 2000s thing we were doing, late 90s, early 2000s. I mean,
Yeah, I loved this era of comedy where comedy didn't take itself too seriously. I think nowadays it's kind of sad because you get a comedy that is raunchy and they almost feel like they have to apologize when they say an off-color joke or something. Have you noticed that? It's like, oh, you shouldn't say that. They'll admonish a character. It'll say something funny and then they'll get told you shouldn't say that. And that just steals like everything from the joke. And back then, we didn't do that. And this movie does have some moments, you know, the transvestite stripper that they're trying to get their money back. Problematic for the, not at the time, but nowadays. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know why it's would be any more problematic now, except that certain people want to make it a big deal. These people have existed literally forever.
Yeah.
So,
I would have to see how they feel about the scene, because it does kind of make fun of that group. I find it funny the fact that he's getting a lap dance and then they have the mirrors everywhere And everywhere he looks is
just big and proud.
Just dick everywhere as he's trying to look away. It's a funny scene.
If you treat that character like they treat it in the movie, yeah, as proud of what they are, into it, like this is what it is, take a good long look.
It's a weird like, character.
I'm all right with that.
Because like she has a feminine voice, and then when she reveals herself, you just take the dress. Hey, what's the matter with you?
And so, I like how they, and okay, so this is not a thinking man's comedy. Let's not act like it is.
No.
But at the end, we meet the transvestite's girlfriend, boyfriend, who's like also clearly a woman, has like a painted on mustache. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, thank you for like another callback, or like builds upon that joke from earlier. And there is a lot, because it's them trying to figure out. We see the pudding at the very beginning. It is, what do they call it? Chekhov's gun. Second to last scene of the movie, we find out why there was a whole thing of pudding in their fridge, and it ties everything together, and it resolves a major plot point.
Without a doubt.
The only major plot point. And so it's not like, this is don't be a menace to South Central while drinking your juice in the hood, where it literally was meant to be a series of like Mad TV or Saturday Night Live sketches just thrown together. It's more thought out than that. It's meant to be stupid. It's stoner comedy. And again, you don't have to come in here and say this is a good movie, because it's not. But it's as good.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought up Cheech and Chong, because we watched Up in Smoke on Jarrett Goes to the Movies, and I'm like, this shit ain't funny.
It's generational.
I have no doubt it's generational.
And that's the thing. It's with this movie. Like you say, you asked how I felt about it. I've loved, you know, idiot comedy for a long time. I mean, growing up, one of the first exposures I had to it was Steve Martin's The Jerk, which is, you know, this is predates Dumb and Dumber, where you have these two morons, you know, like in Dude, Where's My Car? But you have this moron who believes he's black because he was raised by a black family, but he has no rhythm. And the movie is, to me, it's a comedy masterpiece. It's a masterclass that Steve Martin puts on in how to do idiot comedy. Because a movie can have an idiot in it, but if the dialogue, that what they say, is witty and sharp, it catches you off guard. For example, in The Jerk, where the guy is just picking names out of the phone book to snipe people. Again, probably not as funny today, but back then that was kind of a thing, and it is more now today. But he picks out Steve Martin's name, he goes to the gas station, and he starts shooting, but he's missing, he's hitting the cans, and each can's a spring and a leak. And the first thing that Steve Martin does is go, hey, these cans are defective. They're springing leaks.
Then he goes, he hates these cans.
Exactly. So it catches you off guard with that type of humor. And that's the thing that they do here in Dude, Where's My Car? If the lines weren't funny, then it wouldn't carry you through the film. If it was just constant people acting moronic, that's not enough. And like I said, initially, you get that kind of banter, and it's kind of like, okay, all right, these guys are just stupid. And then they start actually having some really snappy dialogue, and it does carry the film. I read in the trivia portion that Ashton Kutcher, when he read the script, said, I'm not doing this. This movie is stupid. And then he got to the dude's sweet tattoo scene, and he couldn't stop laughing. And he said, okay, maybe I've judged this too harshly. And then you start looking back on everything. And those are the kind of things that when you look at this movie as a whole, it's just got those moments. And I got one more before we finish up. And this, I've got a story about this too, is it's the Chinese restaurant, the Chinese food. So this is when they pull in. This is one of the scenes that I know that you really love. I think it's iconic. So let's take a look at the Chinese food sign scene from Dude, Where's My Car?
Let me order.
I'd like
three orders of garlic chicken,
and then
three orders of white rice,
and then
oh hey, you guys want soup?
Sure.
Yeah, three orders of wonton soup.
And then?
Oh, some fortune cookies, too.
And then?
I think that's about it.
And then?
No.
Then wrap it up in a bag.
And then? No, and then. That's all I want.
And then?
And then nothing else. I'm done ordering.
Okay? He's starting to get desperate.
No. See, all I want is the three orders of the garlic chicken and the three orders of the white rice.
And the soup, dude.
And the wonton soup.
And then.
And a cookie's fortune.
And a fortune.
The way that guy talks, too. Backwards like Yoda. Chicken,
the rice, the soup, and the fortune cookies, and that's it.
And then.
He's losing it.
You can put it in a brown paper bag and come put it in my hand because I'm ready to eat.
And then.
I refuse to play your Chinese food mind games.
And then.
No! No and then!
No and then!
No and then!
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 And then!
No! No!
He's starting to make Chester cry.
And then. I'm gonna come in there, and I'm gonna put my foot in your ass if you say "and then" again.
Deliberately waiting. I love it. Yeah, it's so. What's funny about this scene is we have a Chinese food place near us, and it is so awesome because I've been for years when I go there. I always call my wife up and I ask her what, you know, tell her where I'm going. And I always go, "You want anything from Fine Dragon?" Because it's the same lady every time. And that's how she, you get up to the speaker and she doesn't say "and then," but she'll go, "Fine Dragon." And you'll be like, "All right, I want this and this." And she will go, "What else? What else? And what else?" And all I can hear is "and then, and then." And she'll just continually until you finally go, that's it. That's all I want. She will stop, though. But she just goes, "What else? What else?"
I prefer that to pulling up to a fast food place and I'll just have like three kids with me. And I'll go, "Okay, can I have one Happy Meal chicken nuggets with a Sprite?" And they go, "Is that it?"
Yeah.
That's not it. You know that's not fucking it. There's no fucking way I pulled up here to get one fucking Happy Meal, you piece of shit.
What's worse is when they don't even ask, "Is that it?" They just go, you go, "I want one Happy Meal. That'll be $4.25. It's like they've already rung you out.
Greg, do you think it's $4.25 for me to go get a Happy Meal these days? When was the last time you were at McDonald's when they filmed Mac and Me?
I don't get Happy Meals from McDonald's.
I think those things are running you like $7 now.
Oh, that's crazy.
It's fucking outrageous. But anyway, yeah.
It's expensive to have kids.
All right, is that it? Well, what do you think? A kid like rode up here on their tricycle?
At these prices, I mean, seriously.
Yeah, they have to split. Yeah, it drives me fucking crazy. Idiots.
Everybody gets one nugget.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we did talk about that after that scene. It's one of those that does carry it. It's that's when I think the movie actually, when it starts hitting its stride, or scenes like that, and then it becomes one of the things where you, and we've talked about this before. It's a short film. It's 1 hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
That's the shortest movie in our bracket. And compared to everything else, you can sit through 80 minutes of this. It's not that hard. Because what else you got to do?
I challenge somebody to sit down there and watch this and not laugh. And you're allowed to laugh because it's stupid.
Right.
You know, like, that's okay. That's the point. They're not trying to do Blazing Saddles here. They're not doing social commentary. They're not doing satire. They're not doing Woody Allen, you know, sardonically irreverent humor. Yeah. It's dick and fart jokes. It's stoner shit. You know, that it's two clueless guys.
Yep.
And playing off of each other's cluelessness, but they each have like a redeeming quality that gets them through and to the end of this movie. That Chester knows about animals because he watches Animal Planet.
Yeah, that is funny.
And you see several times in the movie that he's like really empathetic. And, you know, even when they're ordering the Chinese food and he's just like, oh man, like this isn't going well. And so I think it's got, I can't say that the movie has heart. It's not like that, but I just think it's got enough of that to, in addition to all the things that you said, just make it a successful movie for what it is. It's a 10 out of 10 for me. No notes for Dude, Where's My Car?
Very good. All right. That brings us to the second movie in the battle. It's going up against Moulin Rouge.
Okay, I'm going to go grab something. So if you want to shout out email or YouTube or smashing subscribe buttons.
You know what? I think I will. What are you going to go grab? Are you going to grab us something to eat?
No, but I have something to show you.
Okay, cool.
All right.
Very good. Hurry back. All right. So while Eric goes to get something to show me, I hope it's not perverted, I want to just say thanks to everybody who joined us tonight on the live stream. And in the chat, thank you so much for being here. It's you guys that keep us doing this. Like I said earlier, we crossed 500 streams on the podcast this week, and that's really nice to see. So if you want to continue to listen to the streams, if you haven't done it before, you can check us out on Spotify, Amazon Music, or Apple Podcasts. All you got to do is look for Box Office Battles, and if you can't see us there, just add the With Greg and Eric, and then you'll be able to find us. Also, if you want to email us suggestions for different categories of battles to do, we're always looking for stuff like that. You can email us at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. For those watching the live stream, it's right there on the screen. If you want to follow our live streams, you can also check us out on Twitch at Box Office Battle Pod. And some of you are already watching it on YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast. We're also on Facebook Live. So thank you. Also remember, like Eric said, and we try to say it every week, smash. That's the thing that the kids say these days. Smash the like and
don't
subscribe.
Don't walk to smashing the subscribe button.
Exactly. And leave a comment, right? Is that what it is? Just anything. Just say we suck and that's fine too.
Just engage with us. Just everything in life now, yes, Greg, is engagement. We need to be engaged.
Right. Well, that brings us to the next movie. Now, here's what's interesting, though, is that this guilty pleasures category is like the first one that we've done where these movies are so polar opposites every week because it's just basically what you and I consider to be those type of movies that we can watch whenever, wherever, whatever time. They're not necessarily mainstream movies for the most part. You know, Legally Blonde and Devil Wears Prada, but they're in a different category. So, yeah, this brings us to Moulin Rouge, a Baz Luhrmann film, who is a very artistic, visionary style director that is definitely not the norm in Hollywood and can be alienating to some audiences. There are people that could watch any of his films, and they are too frenetic, too chaotic for a lot of audiences. And I'd say Moulin Rouge is no different. I think it is chaotic. I think it's frenetic. I think it can be noisy and overbearing, but it's also very beautiful. And it's so artistic on so many levels.
I warn people when I talk about Moulin Rouge that the entirety of Act One, feel free to pause, feel free to rewind, because it happens fast. And like you said, everything's going on. You don't have a second to think about what you just saw because they're getting the entire Act One out of the way in the first about 30 minutes of the film, setting up everything else that happens in Act Two and Three. And this movie's long and it's just like you're along for the ride. It's crazy. I saw this movie in the theaters when it first came out. I remember the credits rolling at the end and just sitting there like, I have never seen anything like this at all. I knew nothing of Baz Luhrmann. I know now that he had previously done Romeo and Juliet, and I've seen that, the Leonardo DiCaprio. And then later he did The Great Gatsby, which I remember. I know he's done other stuff, but those are the three that I know. And there's a style to it. Mm-hmm. There's a pageantry to Moulin Rouge. So I chose Moulin Rouge as part of the Guilty Pleasures movies. And it doesn't quite fit the same mold as Legally Blonde and maybe closer to Devil Wears Prada and Dude, Where's My Car? Because this one is a top five movie for me of all time. Mm. I watch this movie at least once or twice a year.
Interesting.
And it is simply exactly what you said. I mean, now that I know the story, I can pay attention a lot better to the visual details. Obviously, as a musician, this movie, and we'll get into it, is packed with taking old songs and reimagining them. It's, you know, set in, you know, France, you know, in a previous time, you know, Bohemian Revolution time, using songs by Nirvana and mm-hmm. Madonna and things like that. So it's this really interesting mix. It had that big Christina Aguilera
hit. Lady Marmalade.
This movie. Yes, Lady Marmalade. And it's just, there's a lot to it, but this is one of my favorite ones. It doesn't fit the mold quite as much if I'm folding the laundry and it comes on TV. I absolutely would watch it, but it's more a guilty pleasure for me, and that I think traditionally musicals, movies like this, I doubt I'm the target audience for them. And there are plenty of people who, when I say Moulin Rouge is one of my favorite movies, are kind of like, okay, that's kind of weird.
Was that thing with Ken Jeong?
Gay! Yeah.
Gay!
But everyone who knows me knows that I love this movie. And so what I went to get was, when we were doing Jarrett Goes to the Movies, I believe we covered this film.
Oh, okay.
And Amy Pitzinger, who was on the cast mm-hmm. for the last couple of seasons and good friend of ours, is a really good gift giver. She keeps notes in her phone. Like, if you mention anything that you are into, she'll write it down and save it for a rainy day. And all of a sudden, you know, you mentioned that you like some obscure 1960s comic strip and you've got a Amazon package of, you know, a leather bound version of that. It's crazy. So she, as a gift, bought me, it's a script to Moulin Rouge.
Wow.
And it's autographed by Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor and who else?
Jim Broadbent, I would assume.
Jim Broadbent.
John Leguizamo, I would think.
John Maybe. Leguizamo.
Unbelievable.
And so I was like, you know, it's just up in the closet. I don't really have anything to do with it.
Got
to
frame it.
It's just, well, it's, you know, it's an it's entire terrible. Bound.
Oh, we could mat and frame that for you.
Yeah.
My wife could anyway.
So this is
if you send it to me, I'll do
that.
It's
a really neat thing. I'm not sending it.
It may come back with different autographs.
it's right in there with the oil painting of Judge Judy that Casey from the show did for me. So
that's awesome. Speaking of Amy, I just have not gotten around to it. I wanted to contact her and see if she wanted to do a show with us, because we had Sean on here last season.
Yeah.
I wanted to see if she'd be interested in just coming on. I just got to find the right movie for her, because Guilty Pleasure one's kind of a weird. But we've got some stuff coming up. So I'm going to throw it out to her. And maybe for the end of season two, we'll see our old friend Amy Pitzinger here on the show. But yeah, that is really cool. I actually have the from my experience of Moulin Rouge, I saw it in the theater. It was one of the first, we were living in England at the time. And it was one of the first movies that we'd seen at when they started to do the bars in the movie theaters where you could drink inside. I hadn't done that before. And they had food. So it was where they brought the food. They didn't do that in 2000, you know. And, you know, here we are. You know, it was our date night because we had three kids and we hadn't been out in a while. And I loved the movie, but I was more obsessed with ordering chicken wings and getting them delivered to my seat. But the movie was so, again, like you said, I remember it's unlike anything that you had ever seen before. Mm-hmm. The merging of the modern day classic rock and musics with the style of that time period. You know, they throw everything in there, and nothing was sacred. The Like a Virgin scene is outstanding,
man.
So it's one of those films I go back, and I went out and got the soundtrack, had it on CD. I loved listening to it, and I just recently got it on vinyl, and that's good. So it was cool with the script you got. I mentioned to our listeners that my buddy got me a copy of the Roller Boogie soundtrack on vinyl, and we just covered that on the last podcast. It was crazy, but the soundtrack is so good. And it had these reimagining of songs and the medleys of songs. It's like when they do the love medley, of all the different songs of you know, All You Need Is Love, and you know.
So that, I mean, there are plenty of parts of this film that hit me in different ways. The Like a Virgin scene, I think, is by far the funniest thing because of the way that Arthur Zidler delivers those introductory lines. And I remember going, no, wait a second, that seems familiar. She made it through. She didn't know how lost she was until she found you. And then he starts with a melody. She was incomplete. She'd be hard. You know, and there's that. We'll talk about the kind of climactic scene at the end. But the love medley, I think, is what you'll either watch that from the time he enters the elephant Satine's room to the end of the love medley. And if that grabs you, this movie's going to grab you because you're invested in those characters. They are two very different people meeting under really odd circumstances. There's a mix-up. There's a story within a story here that happens. And there's conflict, and there's kind of a push and a pull. And this love medley, he comes back, and he's, you know, you said a lot of things to me about how you were in love with me. Is that true? And she's like, I'm a courtesan. Of course, it's not true. They do this medley, and I know we can't play it because the music will get us kicked off in 1 second. But it, like you said, it's All You Need Is Love. The overture of the film is Elton John's Your Song.
Your Song, yep.
And they reimagined that song in at least three different ways that I can think of, because he starts out in the elephant trying to do his poetry reading to get them interested in putting on their play, Spectacular, Spectacular. She's not having it because she thinks he's a duke and she is supposed to be seducing him to invest. And he's like, why won't this bitch listen to my poetry? Listen, Christian, I've been there. Why won't these bitches listen to my poetry? So he sings, you know, my gift is my song. And I mean, dude, that'll blow your fucking socks off because comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And he's singing it and it's crazy. All right. So they do it that way. And then there's a really slower version of it later because there's some conflict. And then there's an upbeat version of it in the love medley. So, man, it's almost impossible to figure out what it is about this movie that draws me in so much, because it really literally is everything. There's constant underlying conflict because we know as an audience that everything is kind of built on an uneasy balance in the force. We also know as an audience that Satine, the main character played by Nicole Kidman, is dying.
Yeah.
And we find that out in the first act, towards the end of the first act.
Yeah.
She's got tuberculosis, as common in 1899.
Yep.
And I think they call it the consumption
the
film.
Yeah. If you didn't know
she's dying.
If you didn't know the into the handkerchief, which is a clear sign, I think that trope became a trope because of this film. I could be wrong. If I'm wrong, email me and let me know. But the whole cough, cough, cough into the handkerchief and the little blood showing. Now it's like, it's the thing when you know that character is dying.
Yeah.
We were watching The Bear the other day. And are you up to date on The Bear?
I'm not. Don't spoiler it for me. I'm gonna take my headphones. You say whatever you want, but I'm not going to react. I'm going to take my headphones off.
So I won't say.
You can say whatever you want. I don't know. I won't say
particulars. But there's a character that is like, you know, just a character in the show, and
tuberculosis.
No. But they call them up and they go, "Oh, I just got a cold. I'm fine. Don't." And I was like, oh, they're a goner. They're dead. They'll be dead in the next scene.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things that they do now. And I could be wrong. They could go back before Moulin Rouge, but I know, I remember the coughing into the blood and just knowing. And that is interesting because they tell you like right off the bat that she's dead. And then you get to go. And I read somewhere where the actual original ending or the original way the film was supposed to go was Ewan McGregor is telling the story to their child. And they just decided, no, get the kid out of there and just have it. It was a little too much distracting, but it was going to be him telling the story. And so it's kind of like how I Met Your Mother.
Or Princess Bride.
Yeah, another one, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that takes away, and look, this movie's been out now 24 years, so spoilers be damned.
Yes.
It would take away from this movie's devastating to me. Mm. This movie, you know, Christian shows up in France from England wanting to be part of a bohemian scene, a revolution. He's artistic and
he's autistic.
Artistic and he's interested in truth and love and all of these things.
I love the scene where they drop the toothpicks on the floor and he goes,
he counts 542. You see him show up fresh-faced and ready to write and ready to be a part of this revival, this scene, and to see the person that he is at the end of the film, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking because we know she's going to die. She doesn't know she's going to die until about the beginning of Act 3. Mm-hmm. It's almost like they give you that information in order to make you uncomfortable while you're watching the movie, because you know from an outside perspective, no, don't do that because it's not going to pay off. You know, Christian, don't do that. You're basically falling in love with someone who will be dead in a matter of weeks. And it pays off towards the, again, end of Act 2, beginning of Act 3, when they do finally tell her she's going to die.
Right.
And that all of the plans that she had made to run away with Christian, she should intentionally go to him and break his heart and tell him that she doesn't love him. She does love him.
Yeah.
But that the best thing to do in this situation is to go tell him that you don't love him and let him go. And she does. And when she says, I choose the Maharaja, that's how the story ends. And I mean, and she just walks out the door and like, I get chills. Just, I mean, I remember watching it in the theater and just being like, oh, damn.
Yeah, I bet you did.
No, I was crying.
Yeah.
And so, you know, naturally he goes crazy and that's what gets us to this big scene.
Yeah.
And you talk about, so the first 30 minutes are classic Baz Luhrmann, and that last 15 to 20 minutes where they have put on their spectacular. It's basically an Indian somewhat retelling of The Sound of Music in a way.
Right.
And the, you know, it's the graphics, it's the it's so cool.
Yeah.
It's this upbeat, like kind of Bollywood-esque dance number, very like Hindi influenced music. It's so cool.
Gorgeous, a vividly colorfully shot. The different, if you watch here, the different shading of the light from blue to pink.
Yep.
You know, it goes from different types of moods and it gets extremely colorful. When you got the Maharaja looking at it, everything is blue and everything is kind of sinister. And then it picks right back up again. The whole finale is really, it's building to it, because you couldn't have the movie without spectacular at the end.
Right.
Because it's from the very beginning, from the outset, they want Christian to write this play, this musical, and you have to see it. So what's interesting is that watching it again, I'm like, it gets to the point where you almost think there isn't going to be a production because of the Duke and everything like that that's going on. And but then they get to it and then it just goes on. It's a very long musical number that is filled with, you know, the intrigue of where the Christian's going to get shot, and you got the guy waiting in the wings. So it's done extremely effectively. But what builds into this is that their love refusing to die no matter what that was being put in their way and not giving up on it and keep coming back. In spite of her actual death, they continue to fight for that moment. And they do get to have that moment in the end and be able to, regardless of what comes May, they're going to be able to at least be together forever, how long they have.
Yeah. Come What May is another of the songs. This is an original song for the movie.
That's why I threw that out there.
And it is...
I think it's the only original one, isn't it? It's the only like real original song, and it's a beautiful song.
Yes. And it's their secret song that they're going to put into the play so that they will know. They will have a secret that only they know about, you know, like having a secret hand signal or a secret, you know, whatever. So this is their song. And when it plays, you know, then regardless of what's going on around them, that they'll know that they love each other and that they want to be together despite the circumstances. Right. And the song is beautiful. Come What May is a really powerful kind of interpretation of that love that we all wish and hope to find, right? That we'll accomplish what we're going to accomplish together. And it'll never be you versus me. It'll be us versus the world. And yeah, I mean, it's crazy. The soundtrack is really good. It's got some songs in French. I really like the opening. La lune it's kind of like a lullaby almost, you know, and there's a lot of subcontext to it being 1899 France. There's an absinthe scene, you know, a Kylie Minogue plays the green fairy. And so we're tracking through Christian's experience.
Can I give you a bit of trivia on the Green Fairy?
Sure.
So the Green Fairy, do you know who the Green Fairy was supposed to be?
Yes, Nell Carter.
Nell Carter. Where did you pull that from? From Give Me a Break from the 80s?
So, yeah. Give me a break. I know a guy what it takes.
No. It's interesting considering, you know, who'd passed away yesterday. Ozzy Osbourne was supposed to be the Green Fairy. And they, of course, they changed their mind. But if you listen to when she there's a part where she yells, and that's Ozzy's voice that they kept in there from when he recorded the point because it sounded so guttural. And they liked it. So while he didn't fit what they were going to do, it was going to be just kind of humorous. Here's Ozzy Osbourne as the Green Fairy. They knew right away it wasn't going to work. Kylie Minogue is a much better choice, but they left his vocals in there. So just another interesting tidbit of trivia about Moulin Rouge.
That is interesting. And I'm glad they didn't do that because there are...
No, it made sense.
There are parts like the Like a Virgin scene that almost push it into trying a little bit too hard to be a little bit too cute. It pays off because it is a little bit of comic relief at a time when it is really just kind of like bad news after fucking bad news.
Oh yeah.
And we're not only watching what we know to be the demise of Satine and the demise of the relationship. We're also watching like the demise of kind of the heyday of the innocence of the demise of the Moulin Rouge. We're watching, and really, I think the main subtext of it all is the demise of Christian, who shows up as a fresh-faced, you know, person with ideals and dreams and ends up sad, lonely, broken, unable to move, you know, in the scene where he's covered in this blanket on the left and he screams at his friend Henri Marie Maron de la Trousse Malbec, whatever his name was, you know, to just leave him alone.
Yeah.
He, in the scene next to that, when he goes running back to the Moulin Rouge and he shows up with a stack of money, because again, he just got broken up with. Mm-hmm. We know as an audience why. He doesn't know why. He runs back to the Moulin Rouge, and when he has that money and throws it at her feet and says, I've paid my whore, and it's just like, why are you saying that? You know, like, I mean, I'm twisted up going, she didn't mean it. You know, like, well, she loves you. She loves you, Christian.
It's that stages of that perfect love. Love, the whole point of the film that they talk about it. In fact, they devote a whole song to it, is what love will make you do. It's a perfect emotion. It's a perfect feeling. But when it goes wrong,
yes,
it can go really wrong. And you get the jealousy. You get where you say things to your partner that you normally wouldn't say to anybody, because you're trying to affect them in some way, because you can't get the attention you want. So you're going to go and get the negative attention, and it does break you down. And you're right. His character is so bright eyed and full of love. And then he finds the perfect love. Love is an ideal to him.
It's a in the beginning thing.
Yeah. It's an idea that he has in his heart, but doesn't really experience. I mean, he admits that. So it's an ideal, and he ends up meeting Satine, and then he experiences it. And then when it's ripped away, it's gut-wrenching. And so you end up, you know, granted, they get to be together at the end, and it's sad because she passes away, but it's one of those things where he at least got to experience it. You know what they should have had in there? Garth Brooks is the dance.
Jesus fucking Christ.
They should have been the end credit scene. Looking back on the dance we share. Yeah, right here, they could have played it. Memory.
You know how.
If I'd only known. Right here, they could have played it.
How Jesus the King Christ. Falls.
That'd have been a great song for this movie. I'm just saying, missed opportunity.
All right. Well, the scene on the left.
Yes.
And listen, I have no experience at all in the theatrical arts. I don't know. I did some voice acting for
you did.
A cartoon.
You did.
But
Dragon Ball Z, nothing, if I recall.
Yeah. Some thing like that. But it wasn't serious, and I'm not a voice actor. The gut-wrenching, wailing cry that Ewan McGregor pulls out at this. I mean, Greg, and I'm not ashamed to admit, I bawl every time. The way that he yelps and screams to me is like perfect acting, because if the point is to get across what the character's feeling and make the audience feel it, every time I watch this, it's like I'm hearing it for the first time. And I've just watched this man falling in love and then losing it, thinking he's lost it, and then losing it permanently.
Right.
And he just lets out this, it's almost indescribable.
Yeah.
And I mean, it hits me every single time. So I'm curious, you know, obviously Baz Luhrmann, he's got his thing. This is fairly well reviewed on IMDb. Yes. It's a 7.6, which I guess is the highest, or
It's the number one
highest seed. Depending on the.
Yeah, no, it is the highest of all of the guilty pleasure movies. It is like, it's one of these things that on IMDb, 7.6 is pretty high, because this movie can be alienating for some people. I think at the time when it came out, the use of modern music was genius, because had they created a lot of musical numbers that people weren't familiar with, it could have been a little bit more divisive. It could have been something, but you already know these songs, so it's easy to get into the musical numbers. So I think that does bring a lot more people, but it is one of those movies. So yeah, it is the highest rated of all of the ones that we've done.
I want to go back for a second, because you talked about the jealousy. A lot of the songs are reimagined.
Yes.
But I think the biggest like departure from the original is I think it's a tango version of Roxanne by the Police. Yes,
that is a really good moment.
And
the tango scene is incredible. Yeah, very good dance.
He's talking about exactly what you were talking about. And he's dancing with the snitch ass fucking horror. you know, and it's an aggressive dance.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's just, and the vocalization of how that song gets sung is very harsh.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't even say that it's an enjoyable listen as much as it just fits, again, exactly. And I think that's what I'm impressed by, is that in a movie where so much is going on, that it would almost be easy to get some things out of place or for things to not hit the way that they're supposed to. Baz Luhrmann, to me, is kind of like, in a way, like a Wes Anderson, where everything is particularly done in a particular way, in a particular order, in a particular setting, in a particular placement, so that, now, Wes Anderson does it more on a simplicity level, and I think Baz Luhrmann does it on this explosion of sound and color and and action and everything. And, you know, in the dancing scenes, they're using a blur effect to really alienate, you know, I mean, so much going on, but he orders it all exactly right. I think that's a real talent of his. And in a movie that easily could go off the rails because of how much is going on, I don't think the movie shows any restraint. I think he, as a director, shows the restraint to keep it where it needs to be and on track.
I agree.
So I'm really impressed by that.
I'll say something about Baz Luhrmann is that, like I said, it shows in all his films. So you either like him or you don't. Like the Elvis film that he did a couple of years ago, it's very, like, I knew going in, okay, he could either screw this up or he could get it right. What he does with the Elvis movie is something that you've never seen before. And he takes you through Elvis's life quickly, but giving you enough moments to where you can slow down and enjoy a certain moment. Then everything picks back up and runs through some more vignettes, and then he's calming it down. But it's the camera angles, it's the use of color, it's the it is the use of the music in a certain way that comes in and hits you really hard and then jumps back out. I mean, listen to it. There's parts where the song is muffled and then it just kicks into high gear. The blues scene is really good. He does that. Strictly Ballroom's another good movie. He is, and that's the thing about directors. You brought up Wes Anderson. Wes Anderson has a style. And you know that if you're going to go see a Wes Anderson film, and he's going to be later on Box Office Battles, we're going to do a series of Wes Anderson films up against each other. But Baz Luhrmann's the same thing. Stanley Kubrick, these guys do, Martin Scorsese. You know what you're going to get. But is it the substance of the film going to be elevated above the style?
Yeah.
And I think in this one, out of all the Baz Luhrmann films I've seen, in Moulin Rouge, it's the perfect balance.
Nice.
Between style and substance. And I think you get that frenetic, chaotic style, but it's balanced really well with a romantic love story that is gut-wrenching. So yeah, I think it's a fantastic film. I've liked it for a long time. So glad you had it on the list for tonight. I will say that.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you taking a neutral eye to it. You
know, without a doubt.
I watch it often. I've owned the soundtrack. I've owned it on DVD. I've watched the special features. I've listened to the commentary. I've got an autographed version of this.
I did not know all of this. That was good.
This is a big one for me. Empire Strikes Back, Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
You know, these are some really formative and impactful movies in my life. And I think the one last thing I can say about it is that every time I watch it, I feel like the first time I watched it.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
I don't ever kind of get used to the sadness of the story. I don't ever get used to the opening act being crazy. I never get used to the end scene where, you know, Christian is rightfully devastated. And I think a movie like this holding up over time or over multiple watches is a really neat thing. So
yeah, that's really important. I agree. I have movies like that. Empire is one for sure. Could watch it right now. You know, that's the thing about Empire Strikes Back. Put it on. Just love the visuals, and I love the storyline. I watched Rio Bravo, John Wayne. It's one of my favorite films, over my birthday, a few weeks ago. And it was like the first time I watched it. I swear I've watched this movie 100 times. And I have it on 4K and it looks brilliant and it's like never gets old. And I can see how that is for you and it's very important for you. So yeah, it was a good week, you know, good weekend watching both Dude, Where's My Car and Moulin Rouge. I enjoyed it very much. But this is box office battles and we have to decide who wins this battle and moves on to the next round into the final four of all of these movies. So I think last week I went first because it was my side of the bracket. I'm going to let Eric go first this week since these are two of his favorite movies, and we'll see what I think.
Yeah, I mean, so Moulin Rouge is the better movie between Dude, Where's My Car and Moulin Rouge, but we're here to talk about guilty pleasures. It is the reason, and maybe it's a little bit of a cheat, that I wanted to, at the very least, reframe a little bit of what a guilty pleasure means to me. And maybe I could be accused, and I wouldn't fight back too much on it, of kind of reverse engineering that description to fit, you know, how I wanted to vote tonight. But for me, Moulin Rouge is the winner of this. It is my guilty pleasure movie. Men like, you know, quote unquote, men like Die Hard. They like Westerns. They like that. I mean, that Moulin Rouge.
Men like me.
Yeah. is this watchable? Is this impactful?
Yeah, no, I get you.
You know, it is my for sure. Hey, no one's at home tonight. I'll make some popcorn and watch Moulin Rouge and cry, you know, and that's guilty pleasure to me. So for me, it's Moulin Rouge.
In your pink bathrobe.
Yeah, I mean, do some self-care.
The little fluffy get my feathers.
Spearmint eucalyptus body wash.
Your hair really up just, in a towel.
Yeah. Lavender pillow cream, spray.
Cream on your face. Yeah, no. You know, I get it. I like movies of all different genres. And you know, I do not discriminate. If it's a good movie, to me, then I don't care what genre it's in. And I think that's a lot of fun, not limiting yourself to just blow 'em ups. But I do love blow 'em ups. Don't get me wrong. I'll watch a Schwarzenegger 80s film. I'll watch a Stallone. I'll watch anything that,
you know. I love watching Taken, you know, yeah. So like,
I like I'm watching Kung Fu movies. I just, if it's good, it's good. And in this case with Moulin Rouge and Dude, Where's My Car, I really enjoyed both. I had a lot of fun with Dude, Where's My Car. It's just easy to watch. Like you said, it's 80 minutes and you're done. It's got very good one-liners that make you laugh. But in the end, if you want to talk about what is the better guilty pleasure, I think that I think neither of these is really high on people's favorite movies list. But I think that people like both these movies, as evidenced by the 7.6. And I like Moulin Rouge a lot. I have a lot of fond memories of seeing it in the theater and listening to the soundtrack. Still love the soundtrack. So knowing what the audience voted for, I'm going to vote for Moulin Rouge because my vote means nothing at this point.
Did they vote for Moulin Rouge as
by
well?
By one vote.
Oh,
by
no
one
shit.
Vote, a vote on the website. We had it on the Jared Goes to the Movies Facebook page and the Box Office Battles Facebook page.
Nice.
And it won by one vote.
Man.
It was very, very close. So regardless of what I think, what I do think Moulin Rouge, the winner of Box Office Battles, battle number three of Guilty Pleasures is indeed Moulin Rouge. So let's give it up for Moulin Rouge.
And you can tell everybody this is your song.
So that's good. Going back to Baz Luhrmann, I did want to mention that I talked about the Elvis movie. He just announced that while he was making that movie, now this is if you're an Elvis nerd like me, and I do love Elvis, I can't help it. The weird thing is that I, when I was growing up, couldn't stand him. My mom played him all the time. So it's kind of that connection to my mom. When my mom, I left home, I missed it. And that's, yeah. I think a lot of people have that kind of connection. And now that she's passed away, I like to keep that memory alive. And so I'm a big fan. And have always been, and I got that from her. It's one of the few things that she gave me in life, and she gave me something fun. But
there you go.
Baz Luhrmann uncovered, when he was in the Warner Brothers vaults, he uncovered two or three gigantic canisters of film that was not used for Elvis, That's the Way It Is, and Elvis in Concert, two of his concert films. He has re-edited, re-spliced, and put it together in a new Elvis in Concert movie. It's premiering at the Toronto Film Festival in September, I believe, for their 50th anniversary, and will be released next year for general audiences. So that's just an interesting thing. If you like Baz Luhrmann and you like Elvis, you got that to look forward to.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
And you do.
I do. And speaking of, we have one more battle left in the guilty pleasures category. We're going back to my bracket.
Yeah, this is you.
This is me.
Some Elvis thing.
We got an Elvis movie. Yeah. No kidding. It is going to be Elvis in the 1966 racing classic. We're going to win this race. Spin out.
We're going to spin out, baby.
Going up against, and I think you'll enjoy, if you haven't seen, have you seen Deep Blue Sea?
No.
Oh, I think you'll enjoy it. It's not as like Sharknado bad, but it's fun. It's a shark, giant monster shark movie. It's one of those, again, guilty pleasure. I can put this
they
on.
They trained the shark on AI or something? What are you?
They inject it with a hormone to make it smarter.
Okay,
for good. Some unbeknownst reason.
Well, we're going to find out. Don't give away.
And then
you've
got the tagline. Bigger, smarter, faster, meaner. And that's what we have to look forward to. The next battle will be Tuesday, the 5th of August. Battle 4 and our guilty pleasures. So we got that to look forward to. That's going to be a lot of fun. Elvis versus Jaws.
Yeah, baby.
Who comes out on top? Join us on YouTube, Facebook Live, and Twitch in a couple weeks, Tuesday, August 5th. Thank you to everybody who joined. Again, we gave out the email before, but I'll give it one more time. BoxOfficeBattles@gmail.com. Twitch is Box Office Battle Pod. YouTube is at Box Office Battle Podcast. Go to our Facebook page, Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. Like it, subscribe, all that good stuff. And same thing with all of the podcast providers, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Apple Podcasts. Please do so. Keep us going, and we'll be here each and every week. Thanks for all that joined the live stream. I really appreciate it, and we will talk to you in a couple weeks. Eric, before we go, Moulin Rouge is the winner, so I know you're happy. Anything you got to say before we depart this wonderful, wonderful realm of YouTube?
Yeah, baby. Until next time. You guys be excellent to each other.
We're going to win this race in a couple of weeks. Good night, everybody.